Thank you for joining our webinar today on proposed changes to the Medicare Shared Savings Program and the implications for independent practice. I'm the Executive Director of the Partnership to Empower Physician-Led Care, or PEPSI, as we like to call it. I will say a little bit more about PEPSI in a few moments, but I first want to introduce our two speakers. We will have Farzad Mostashari walk us through the proposed changes to the Medicare Shared Savings Program rule. Farzad is co-founder and CEO of Allidaid. Founded in 2014, Allidaid partners with independent primary care doctors to support their movement to value-based care through accountable care arrangements. Allidaid currently partners with more than 300 practices with more than 330,000 patients across 23 states. Dr. Mostashari is also the former National Coordinator for Health IT at the Department of Health and Human Services. Our second speaker today will be Dave Spaulding. Dave is the Chief Operating Officer at the Texas Medical Association's Practice Edge. TMA Practice Edge is a physician's services organization launched by the Texas Medical Association to empower independent physicians in Texas to stay independent and move to value-based care. Dave has significant experience in healthcare management and has specialized in managing new ventures and high-growth businesses. He also works with their specialty care business there with the Texas Medical Association. Before I turn it over to Farzad to walk us through the implications of the proposed rule, I just wanted to take a moment to introduce PEPSI very briefly and to level set on some of the results that we've seen through the Medicare Shared Savings Program to date. The Partnership to Empower Physician-Led Care is an advocacy organization dedicated to supporting independent practices and achieving value-based care. You can see our mission statement here on this slide, as well as a list of our members. We have six members currently: Allidaid, the American Academy of Family Physicians, MGMA, the Texas Medical Association, Florida Medical Association, and the California Medical Association. Our goals, before I move into the ACO program, I will say that you can see more of our policy priorities on our website, which is www.physiciansforvalue.org. One of our primary objectives as we think about the future of independent practice is making sure that there are opportunities for value-based care and that independent physicians can see value-based care really as a path to sustainability. Incumbent in that, or inherent in that, is making sure that there's not only a quantity, an appropriate quantity of value-based care arrangements for physicians to participate in, but that they're also an appropriate quality. We can say more, a little bit more about what we mean by that, but in general, when we're thinking about independent physicians, our advocacy is really geared towards making sure that there are arrangements that are appropriate for independent physicians given their unique circumstances. So as we move into talking a little bit about the ACO program, I will let the experts get down to it shortly, but I did just want to put up this slide, which shows some of the most recent MedPAC data. The key takeaway from this slide is that ACOs are generating savings. The program overall has achieved savings. The savings may be modest, but they are higher in two-sided models. So you can see here, MSSP Tracks 2 and 3, Pioneer, and NextGen all had some amount of savings. So you may see headlines or have seen stories suggesting otherwise, but the cold hard data here from MedPAC shows that the program has been successful. And that, as we will hear shortly, the path for moving forward is to build on some of the successes. The last thing I wanted to mention here before letting the speakers take it away is that the HHS Office of Inspector General did produce a report looking at the Medicare Shared Savings Program, and specifically key markers of success or components of success given the program performance to date. So you can see here, there are several common elements of ACOs that achieved savings. And one of them, for purposes of PEPSI, that we always like to call out is that physician-led ACOs were more likely than other types of ACOs to see success under the program. So, we can say a little bit more about that, and we will say a little bit more about that. But PEPSI was really built on the belief that physicians are the cornerstone of medicine, and we should ensure that there are opportunities for this important segment to participate in value-based care, so this OIG report is really aligned with our philosophy and mission. So I'll now turn it over to Farzad Mostashari to talk about the proposed regulatory changes and some of the key takeaways from the NPR.
Thanks so much, and thanks everyone for joining us. I would love to take folks through. We've been obviously reading the rule with great interest, and please do, if you have technical questions, don't be afraid to toss them over. I'm here, but I also have Travis Broom, who's our head of policy, and Sean Kavanaugh, who used to run Medicare, here in the room with me. So you got a bunch of ringers, not including me, here to ask any of the technical, detailed questions you've always wanted to ask. But I think the first to start with the rule, I guess I'll share that when I first started to look at the rule and the fact sheets and so forth before I started to dig into the whole thing myself, I was a little bit impacted by looking at like, oh, they're going to delay it and it's going to the sharing rates down for the gain share model. So I guess my first impression was kind of negative, but fortunately I held off on tweeting too much until we read the thing. And I think my key takeaways now are kind of different than they were in the first hours after the rule. My key takeaways, one, is that they really, really acknowledged the unique value of physician-led ACOs. And this, and as we'll hear, like they actually created a designation for what Pepsi is all about, right? Of the idea that independent practices may in some ways be the keys to success in value-based payment arrangements. And so that was huge. And they really have worked to address some of the concerns that that this group, Pepsi, identified in that first letter that we sent to Administrator Verma some time ago. And Kristen, maybe you can put that in the show notes in the chat channel. For folks if they want to refer to later. But in terms of the nuts and bolts of what they proposed, what the net impact we think is going to be is that it helps increase predictability and increase the opportunity for appropriate savings, particularly for physician-led ACOs, earlier. And we've had many this experience now with many ACOs who, because of the way the benchmark was defined, would have to work for years and years and years without seeing the financial returns of it. In some areas and in other areas of the country, they were getting paid no matter what you did. You were gonna get a savings check. This introduces, I think, a little bit more parity and predictability into the program for that. It also, you know, this is no surprise. They said they were going to do this 100 times. So no one should be surprised, right, that it motivates ACOs to move to risk sooner, both by decreasing the amount of savings in the gain share only track, but also by limiting the duration in which you can be in those tracks. Again, totally predictable that they would do that. But the other important thing is they ask for comment, and this is, as a former regulator, I can tell you, like, when they ask for comment, they mean it, right? They're serious, and there are lots of areas here where they said, look, this is what we thought, but we considered these other two or three ideas, and we really want to hear from you. So it's going to be really important for us as Pepsi and as individuals to respond and to provide them with your opinion, but actually with facts and perspectives from on-the-ground experience. So timeline, rule was released August 9. The pretty version was released last week. Final comments due October 16th, and then the final rule, my best guess is I would be doubtful that it would come out in December, but maybe late, you know, December or January would be my guess, but certainly there has to be enough time, again, for them to be able to do, open up the application period in time for July 1, 2019 starts, as we'll see. Next slide. All right, so the first point is that Unfortunately, the delay in getting the rule out, the rule went to OMB on May 1st. If it had gone, come out, the final rule, the proposed rule rather, had come out in June, we could have been looking at a January 2019 start for this program, but as we were hooting and hollering that these delays are going to delay the implementation of the program, well, sure enough, the performance year for new 2019 ACOs can't start in January 2019. It would start in July 1st of 2019, which means that the reg writers have to write about 100 pages on how to accommodate this half year and what happens to the two periods and what's the attribution and what's the risk and how do you move and all that kind of crazy, kooky stuff. So there's a bunch of complexity around the half year. It's a one-time thing. Whatever, we'll get through it, and it's not going to, when the long, you know, history of this program is written, this is going to be a very small footnote, but it sure feels like for, you know, practices who have signed up and are ready to go in a performance year, it's kind of a bummer to have to wait till July instead of starting in January. For existing 17 and 18 ACOs, they already have a three-year agreement, and they could continue that agreement. They can stay into that current agreement under the current rules, more or less, until it expires. So nothing needs to change for them. They have the option, though, and you know, that there's value to option, right? Optionality and choice. They have an option to move into a new agreement sooner. They can move into it as soon as July 1, 2019, or January 2020, or if you're one of the 2018 ACOs, you can even wait until 2021 to go into the new ACO. Getting into those new ACO agreements, going into that new agreement sooner would let you take advantage of regional benchmarking sooner. So that would be a good option for ACOs that on average tend to be regionally efficient. Our experience at Aledade has been, and we're only physician-only ACOs, that nearly all of our ACOs start off with some regional efficiency just because independent practice, and there's a bunch of research to show this, tend to be more efficient. Their patients tend to cost less. They don't have as many unnecessary procedures and surgeries and hospitalizations and even readmissions. So this is just fundamentally moving the regional efficiency sooner into contract period one will help those independent physician ACOs. If you're a 16 ACO, your agreement, your MSSP Track 1, say, agreement, would have expired at the end of this year. They're going to extend it for another 6 months. So you can now enter the Track 3, which is called Enhanced Track. You could enter it sooner, or you could wait until July. You can't wait. You gotta move on July 1, 2019. If you're a 14 or 15 ACO, again, you have an agreement. You can finish that agreement. If, on the other hand, you were taking risk before, you were in a performed two-sided risk model of some sort, in your next agreement period, you actually jump to a 50% regional benchmark approach. You are, quote-unquote, experienced. So that's the kind of, if you have an existing ACO, put yourself, think about which year you belong to, and these kind of help guide you. Most of the time, what it means really is, I can keep doing exactly what I was planning on doing, or I could have an option of switching to these more regional efficiency favoring tracks sooner. That's really the basic decision. Next slide. All right, they did three big bucket of things. There's a ton of, obviously, in there, but I think for either existing ACOs or those considering ACOs, comparing it to the old program, the fundamental kind of economic terms, there's three main areas to think about. Number one, glide path to risk. Number two, enhanced flexibility. Number three, benchmark, benchmark, benchmark. All right, let's take these first each in turn. So, glide path. You know how before they talked about like, all these tracks, right? And there was almost a sense that there are these parallel tracks that recede into infinity. Well, you don't have that anymore. It's a glide path where there's this real expectation of progress down one track. You start off in basic. You get automatically, we don't have to do anything. You will automatically be moved from A to B to C to D to E, increasing levels of risk, increasing levels of reward, and then you have to go to enhanced. So there's this sense of like you're on an escalator that is moving you up the ladder. They add, you know, if you really want to think about it in terms of anchoring to former terminology, enhanced is almost exactly like track three. So think of enhanced as track three. Think of basic AB, where you enter, as track one, except the gain share, the proposed, you know, is cut down to 25%. Think of basic E as track one plus. It's almost exactly like track one plus. What they did was they introduced these new kind of intermediate steps between track one and track one plus, and we can call that basic C and D, where the upside creeps up and the downside creeps up. They importantly, we didn't color them orange because they do not count as advanced alternative payment models. There is some downside risk in them, but not enough to trigger the more than nominal financial risk definition. So they're proposing that basically when you get to like the track one plus level of risk, then it's an AAPM, and you get to there, you have to get there basically by year five of your basic agreement, or you can elect to go sooner. You can start off in basic E and AAPM if you'd like to in basic, and in fact, if you're experienced previously, you kind of have to move through the tracks a little bit more quickly. So this is the basic journey here. And here's what we're talking about. Physician ACOs, what they call low revenue, are given special recognition, and we think it's for good reason. So they categorize ACOs on a degree of what they call degree of control over total Part A and B fee-for-service spent, right? And the argument that they're making is, look, if you control more than 25% of the total expenditures for assigned beneficiaries, you should be able to do more. You have a lot of revenue coming in. You should be able to, you know, manage downside risk. You should be able to do more. If you, on the other hand, are low revenue, and this includes in terms of the current classification, they took a look back and they said, how well did this compare to, you know, physician only or with a hospital or whatever? And they found that under the, you know, the current composition, again, this doesn't account for what people are going to do in the future if they try to game this thing, but under the current classifications, it did a very good job of differentiating between physician only and hospital. In fact, the Office of the Actuary said that the optimal cut point under the current structure is 10%, but they increased it to 25%. So presumably a few, you know, small hospital groups may sneak in, but they're sure to get almost all the physician only or multi-specialty ones would come in under this definition of low revenue. And they said, okay, if you're low revenue, you can stay in basic for a longer period of time. You don't have to go to enhanced. If you're experienced, you can enter into basic or enhanced. Don't have to go in right into enhanced. And they ask for specific comment on, like, well, what else could we do to make the low revenue risk more manageable for the low revenue ACOs? Why do they care about keeping low revenue in? Well, one of the principles that they talked about of the goals of the program is competition, wanting to make sure that this program does not further hospital consolidation, and even they said, some have even suggested that physician-led ACOs can prevent a consolidation. Well, we certainly agree with that, having seen it in daily work, that being able to band together does provide practices an opportunity to stay independent without going to risk. So this table is something that I had not seen before for PY 2016, and it is amazing. What it shows is that when people say, oh, the program doesn't save money, and Kristen talked about this, and we, you know, actually in the there's 10 pages there on the impact assessment, which are like amazingly, they lay out all the ways in which there are spillover effects and areas with ACOs, the costs are going down compared to areas that don't have ACOs. But this table like smacks you in the face, right? What's going on here? Among the high revenue ACOs, which is 222 ACOs, which is more than actually two-thirds of the patients are in these high revenue ACOs, they, to a first approximation, did nothing. The number of ACOs that had costs over the benchmark and under the benchmark were about the same number of dollars over and below the benchmark. It's almost like random, right? And yet, if you're below the benchmark, Medicare paid you. Medicare paid them $247 million. And this is what's getting them pissed off, right? They're like, why, what are we paying for if the net savings from the program is nothing for those high revenue ACOs? And in fact, they may be using this as a way to increase consolidation. So that's what they're concerned about. But look at the top row. The top row is physician ACOs, and they saved $500 million just in 2016, which is, you know, pretty darn good. And certainly makes this idea that somehow, you know, the ACO program has been a disappointment, I think makes that not true. So you want to double down on those low revenue, and you want to cut out the payments to the high revenue, which is exactly what they're proposing to do. All right, so that was number one. Number two, more flexibility, and generally more choice is a good thing, gives you options. So stuff that CMS used to decide for you, like prospective or retrospective or how quickly you go to risk, now you can decide for yourself. That's a good thing, nothing wrong with that. And once you're in a two-sided model, you can choose your own MLR, MSR, which you could before. I think there's going to be more people who are in this situation, and they make it a little bit easier with the beneficiary incentive program and SNF waivers. All good. Next. This is the big thing, though. In terms of you're talking economics, the big thing that matters is what's the benchmark, what's the counterfactual, and the big problems that we had identified before with the benchmark was one, regional trend, right? So if you're in an area where the secular trends in that region are coming down, you're going to make money no matter what. If their costs are going up, you're not going to make money, right? So we had the situation where on a commercial contract, our ACOs crushed it, and we can see that costs were going up gangbusters in that state, but on our MSSP program, it showed that we were above benchmark, right? So if costs went up 10% and they only went up 2% on our ACO, they counter that as a negative against us. So now they're going to move regional trend right into the first contract period. They're actually moving regional efficiency also into the first contract period, which we did not expect, to be honest. NACOS, I think, says that they advocated for this, but I was surprised to see this in the first year, first agreement period. So it really favors physician-led ACOs and others, independents who are efficient. And what they said is that if you're efficient, you get 35% of the regional cost blended in the first one. If you're not, so that helps you. If you're not efficient, only 25% of the regional cost. So it blunts it a little bit, the effect for those. Second contract period, 50% if you're efficient, 35% if you're not. Third agreement is 50-50 for everybody. They also allowed some acknowledgement that your risk can change in your population. It can go up as well as down. As you all remember, before, risk could go down, but it could never go up. That was really kooky, and it really hurt a lot of folks because the population changes, taking on insurance risk. They changed that. They opened the door to allowing risk to float up as well as down. But what's the problem? They capped it at 3% over 5 years. That is not a lot, folks, 3% over 5 years. But they left the door open again to increase that amount as appropriate. So I think in conclusion, again, remember, right, this is a proposed rule. They're going to look for comments. We're going to submit comments as PEPSI, and I think as individual groups, I strongly encourage folks to think about these. I think if you're thinking about the future of the program, the key economic terms to focus on is going to be, one, increasing that regional efficiency and risk coding caps. The point being, gaining regional efficiency wasn't easy, and holding it down ain't for free either, right? So if you want to make the program more like Medicare Advantage, which is what they said that they want to do, and Seema Verma said in her health affairs article, well, you know, Medicare Advantage does not cap your risk coding. It may adjust it if there's a lot of inflation, and that's fine, but it doesn't cap it, and it certainly doesn't cap regional efficiency. So we would say, make it more like Medicare Advantage, get rid of or increase those regional efficiency and risk coding caps. The second is, again, Seema Verma in her health affairs article said, we are dealing with the problem of rural ACOs. If you make up a big portion of your comparator population, if you have a big market share, then you have this problem that Travis on our team had written about in AJMC, where you have almost like a You know, if you do better, then you make the region look better, and then your gains are discounted, essentially, proportional to what portion of the market you are, which really hurts rural ACOs. They tried to address it, and they utterly failed. Their approach to fixing it totally doesn't work, and they say it doesn't work, and they're asking for more comments, and to which we say, yeah, what about you take our beneficiaries out of the regional comparator? How's that? And then finally, they specifically asked for comment on, okay, could we make the economics better for the low-revenue ACOs, particularly in the first contract period? And if you think about it, all in all, everything I've said right now, if you're an existing ACO, this is actually pretty good for you, even if the rule is finalized as proposed. Where this hurts is those new ACOs, new practices coming in, and they're only going to get 25% share, which really limits the number of the stuff you can do to get savings that don't have a 5-to-1 ROI. So that, I think, is something that they are open to considering reducing the minimum savings rate in the upside-only models for physician-led ACOs and potentially either giving a little bit of a tailwind to them, giving us a percent or two, or increasing the share percent for those low-revenue independent ACOs in one-sided risk, basic A and B. So those are, I think, our three big bucket ways to improve the program. It's got to be three.
Okay, thank you, Farzad. I think we will. I think we'll hear next from Dave Spaulding, and then, folks, if you have questions on some of the specifics about the rule or anything from our next presenter, we'll have time for questions right at the very end. So, our next presenter is Dave Spaulding from the Texas Medical Association's Practice Edge. I introduced him earlier, but Dave is a longtime healthcare executive focused on the business side of healthcare and has been working with the Texas Medical Association's physician-led ACOs as they plan for the future of their program. So he's going to focus, you know, we just heard about the rule, but Dave is going to focus now on give a little bit of perspective on how their ACOs are thinking about the future and some of the things that they're thinking about as they look towards moving to greater amounts of risk. Dave? I unmuted you. You should be able to talk now.
All right. This is Dave Spaulding, and you all can hear me or no?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Kristen and Farzad. Thank you for that great review of that information. As Kristen mentioned, I'm Dave Spaulding, and I work at the TMA Practice Edge. Just a little bit of background on our organization. If you're not familiar with the Texas market, the Texas Medical Association has about 51,000 members now, and it's, I believe, the largest state medical society in the country. And the majority of the physicians in the membership are in independent, in private practice, and independent physicians. So it is a really big, big area with a lot of independent physicians. And not surprisingly, the TMA formed this company several years ago called Practice Edge, and we are a service company that supports independent physicians who want to succeed in these models. And what we've been able to do across the state in the last few years is pull together 13 discrete ACOs that are comprised of about 600 physicians. There's probably about coming up on about 250,000 attributed lives coming up in January is what it looks like. And these are really, for us, what's interesting is many of these physicians are in solo practice, and they own the ACOs, they govern them themselves, and this is a big part of our strategic initiative behind this. So we've been very excited to be involved in this, and we actually had an ACO collaborative a couple of weeks ago, and Kristen came and spoke with us, talked about the proposed rules. I think she was 100 out of 100 on her projections of what would be in the proposed rule that came out. And but we were together, and we get together about once a year with our ACO leaders. These are physicians who are presidents of the ACOs and put in a lot of extra time that make these programs successful, some of their board members who are also physicians, and they all come together once or twice a year to really roll up their sleeves and get to work on some of the hard work to make these programs go forward. And what was real interesting that I'd like to highlight for this call is we have in our franchise four groups that had Track 1 ACOs, and all of those groups had actually elected independently and before this announcement to move to Track 1 Plus. So that this was, you know, a lot of work that had been going on in the last year. And even more interestingly, I think one of them started in 2014, one in 2016, and one in 2018. And another had also was, I think, a 15 potentially. So we had a really interesting just market activity related to that find it pretty fascinating. And I think it's an endorsement for a lot of these activities in this proposal. And Farzad, I'm excited to hear that you're excited about the proposal and as you keep digging into it as well. When we were together, because so many of our groups are going to risk, the focus of this collaborative became, and the physicians really drive what they want to talk about. We spent a lot of time working on post-acute care and in the redesign of that activity, which is a lagging activity, but a really critical one for the long-term success of the program. We had some physicians who shared their annual wellness visit approaches, which has always been complex for us to execute on. Attribution methodologies were another big area where we spent a lot of time rolling up our sleeves. And the one that really is, it never really ends, is the physician engagement. Our physicians come together and they're looking for ways to continue to build that and improve that and grow on that. And I think that going into risk contracts will definitely require the engagement and focus that everybody needs to have when you've got downside risk involved. So that's a bit of what's been happening. One of the things I wanted to share, for those of you who may not be as deep into the details, and I'm going to mask this group, if you don't mind, but we did analyses for all of our clients who were considering Track 1 and Track 3 and Track 1 Plus. It was primarily Track 1 Plus versus Track 3. And the amount of risk that that the groups would be looking at, again, one of our examples, we ran 102% MLR to see what that downside scenario would do for the group. And under the methodologies that are in existence today, the group itself under Track 1 Plus would have about $500,000 loss under this scenario. And under a Track 3, that would have been about probably for the group about $1.3 million as an example of some of the differences. And further, we looked at these loss sharing limits, which we now have these revenue-based opportunities under Track 1 Plus that I hope you're all familiar with. That actually takes the analysis and the loss for this particular ACO would be actually down to about $300,000 based on that particular methodology, which is, again, to enable and support, prioritize independent physicians and recognize their financial position consideration. The same group looking at a Track 3 loss sharing limits, and so to remind everybody, that is 15% of the ACO's benchmark. That could be, in the Track 3, over $12 million for this particular group. So in our analysis, Track 1 Plus is $300,000, Track 3, $13 million. As a potential loss. And clearly, you're not getting as much upside, but there's still significant upside in Track 1 Plus. So we're really grateful to the work that was done before to even create, you know, the Track 1 Plus, and are just hopeful that, again, that the regional benchmarking, all of that activity is just making this, you know, an even better opportunity than, you know, our groups were to go forward with it without some of those changes. So we're excited about that. Just as another opportunity for people to understand, there are waiver opportunities, and our groups had all selected the SNF waiver, just as another piece of information for you all to think about. So that was really what I wanted to share about, you know, how excited we are in Texas. The commercial payers in our state are also trying to increase. There's the amount of risk in the market. There are a lot of commercial ACO opportunities in the state. Texas, Dallas, well, not, I wouldn't say just Dallas, but because we have some major metro areas with a lot of employer activity, we do have all four of the major commercial carriers are active in the state, across the state, and also Medicare Advantage is very significant. So we've got a robust market, and we are seeing that market go from kind of the PPO, ACO, if you will, also trying to drive into some commercial risk. And maybe we'll be able to actually use some of these enhancements to try to bring them into the commercial market. So, Kristen, that's kind of what I had today.
Okay, thanks, Dave. So I hope everyone's found the presentation to be useful. I think our goal was, you know, as mentioned previously, the Partnership to Empower Physician-Led Care, PEPSI, focuses on supporting opportunities for independent practice and making sure that those opportunities are appropriate given the financial circumstances of this unique piece of the healthcare sector. So, you know, as Farzad mentioned, there are a number of changes coming down the pike. Some of them are expected, some of them a little bit less expected. All of them, in our belief, many of them, I should say, not all, but many of them, very positive and welcome developments. I think Dave really helpfully gave us a snapshot of what ACOs are thinking on the ground, the ACOs in Texas. Some of what they're thinking about, such as which track to move into and when to do it, some of that will be impacted or at least shaped in some ways by the proposed rule. But there are other things that they're thinking about, like physician engagement and post-acute care and some of their strategies around preventive visits and preventive care that is something that will go on regardless of the changes in the proposed rule. So, I think we got a good snapshot there of, you know, both the policy and regulatory space, but also some of the practical implications on the ground. I would like to, at this time, I don't know if folks have been asking questions over chat, but at this time, I'd like to see if anyone has any questions that they want to ask on the line. If you do, please feel free. I think you should all be able to unmute your phones. So please feel free to unmute and ask a question. I only ask that you identify yourself by name and organization, if you can, before you ask your question.
I got one question here, which is about the six-month start and AAPM. And the question is, if you enter into the basically if you enter into either basic E or enhanced, beginning July of 16, does that count as an advanced alternative payment model for the whole year? The answer is it does.
Hi.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry. This is Joanna Chua from Lake Region Healthcare. Our contract is expiring at the end of this year, but if we choose to not extend that and not be part of an ACO for the first 6 months of next year and decide to join one for in July, what is the MIPS implication for not being part of an ACO the first half of the year?
This is Travis. So basically, it follows the same logic that Farzad just laid out with the advanced alternative payment model. You know, they run three checks every year to see if you're in an advanced alternative payment model or a regular alternative payment model, i.e. a non-risk-taking ACO. So if you were in a non-risk-taking ACO in July, you would come through, you would hit that same check that got the advanced APMs. You would show up as a regular APM, so you'd still be in MIPS, but you would get all of the advantages of being an AAPM and MIPS, you know, universal quality reporting through your APM, no, the performance improvement category wouldn't be there, and then obviously everybody does.
I think in general, if you're in a track one, there's really no harm in continuing it for another 6 months. You could, what they do is they'll annualize your performance for that full year, and they'll literally cut it in half to account for that front half of the year. So if you're in a track one, one-sided program, if you think you're going to continue beginning July in one of the new models, I don't see any downside to you continuing extending the contract for another 6 months.
Thank you.
Another question that's come up is around the quality measures, and most of the quality measures were dealt with in the physician fee schedule proposal. There was something new here, which was around use of certified EHR technology, where they proposed to eliminate that as a quality measure for the ACO program. It does remain for MIPS. However, they want to add a new requirement that ACOs report on the aggregate for all of their participants, whether they're doing kind of three key things, use of certified EHR technology for patient access and interoperability and so forth. So the net effect of that, as long as you're in MIPS land, is that it frankly is an added burden for the ACOs. But if you're in an AAPM land, then removing meaningful use ACI as a quality measure theoretically could reduce the burden of reporting on the practices, because the individual practices don't have to do anything at that point. Just the ACI has to, that ACO has to pinky swear that their participants are using the technology to that extent. So. Again, in the burden reduction category, it's not huge, but once you're in an AAPM, it reduces the reporting on the specific, all those, you know, MU type measures, and it makes it one kind of grand overall aggregate. Are you, you know, using certified EHR technology across the board? But the devil's always in the details.
Kristen, this is Dave again. This is more curiosity, but you're talking to the low revenue, quote unquote, you know, ACOs. Any indication how high revenue ACOs are reacting to this change, the proposed change?
I have heard some groups starting to think about whether they can sneak in under the low revenue category by removing certain participants from their ACO list.
We should
I think
say that they're
that interesting.
That
yeah,
is not
should,
the intention, I think, of the rule. And you know, in the track one plus, they had a similar kind of opportunity for physician only, and they said we would review the ownership of the ACO participants, ownership and governance, which may be a, you know, a clue as to what, you know, what the goals of this, the intentions of the regulators are here.
Yeah, that was the other thing I was going to add, is that there is an extensive discussion in the rule about the oversight that CMS plans to do to make sure that there is not gaming going on, and that, you know, ACOs are not disbanding and then rebanding to get more time in a one-sided model, for example. So I think that they very clearly outlined the checks that they plan to put in place to make sure that that the ACOs, new or otherwise, are meeting the goals of the program as they view them.
Yeah, I want to pick up on the gaming thing. They actually put it as one of their principles is that they want to reduce opportunity for gaming in the ACO program. And I think if you have worked at CMS, it is natural that you consider all the ways in which people can try to take advantage of loopholes to get, you know, get money that they didn't deserve out of the taxpayer. So that's natural that they would do that. But in terms of how big a problem that is in the ACO program, I don't see any evidence that gaming is a big problem in the ACO program. In fact, when I would suspect gaming is when the published results of the program, what they, you know, you paid out, compared to an academic study that says, well, if we do it the right way and we compare, you know, controls and do the calculations right, what you would, if there were a lot of gaming, what you would find is that the program is showing people are getting great results and a lot of money is being paid out, and the academic study shows no savings whatsoever. That's kind of what happened with bundles, right? Where they're paying a lot of money out in bundles, and presumably people are reducing costs, except when the academic study came out, there really wasn't much of a difference, at least in the early years in the voluntary program. In the ACO program, we see exactly the reverse, right? The stated savings on the program are modest. The academic study of how much impact it actually had is much, much, much bigger. So to me, like being so concerned about gaming that you put in stuff like 100% tax bracket, marginal tax bracket on savings above, you know, whatever, 5% regional efficiency and being really stingy with risk coding, like all this kind of stuff. If you look at the $2.1 billion of savings that they're saying this proposal will create compared to current state, $2.1 billion, $1.6 billion of that is coming out of payments to ACOs. Some of that, great, right? Like if high revenue ACOs aren't doing anything and they're getting paid for nothing, great, cut that off. But, you know, shouldn't we be looking to grow the pie here, right? Shouldn't there be more savings to the taxpayer from fewer claims-based costs? And aren't we, these two are a little bit at tension here, right? This idea of, I don't want to give a lot to the ACOs, right? Reduces ACO participation, which reduces total savings. And I think this is one area where they're on the balance of the program, they should encourage more participation so you get more savings for the taxpayer instead of being really focused on being stingy with the ACOs so that you're sure that you don't get gamed.
Okay, hearing no questions, thank you all for joining this webinar hosted by the Partnership to Empower Physician-Led Care.